Don't get it twisted. This rap game is mine, and it's not a fucking game. Fuck what you heard. It's what you hearing. It's what you hearing. Listen. It's what you hearing. Listen. It's what you hearing. Listen. X gon' give it to you.
Welcome to Galacticus, your purple planet-eating podcast. I'm your host, Scott Brown. As usual, I've got Jim Kettner.
Let's get extreme.
Okay. And John Mahaly.
90s, man, 90s.
Yes, that's right. As it may be obvious now, we are talking about 90s, specifically 90s comics, and we're using the film Deadpool as a starting point to dig into this this pouch-infused, sword-wielding, ponytail-clad topic. So,
he doesn't have a ponytail.
He doesn't.
Come on.
But I'm,
come on, you want to put a you're pinning the ponytail on everything.
He may have had a okay.
Like, pin the ponytail is a very 90s game with 90s superhero character design, and I would not be surprised if you go through the Rob's sketchbooks that there's probably some iteration of a Deadpool sketch where the ponytail was a factor.
And even if the main man himself, if he doesn't have a ponytail, do you want to do a plus or minus a number of characters with ponytails in comics featuring Deadpool? I think we're talking about like a 3.5 over under to work with.
The fact that there are no ponytails made it into the movie is actually a little bit distressing. It's one of the ways in which I think that it wasn't very faithful to the source material.
Okay, so before we start going down this rabbit hole, let's take it back a little bit. We're going to start by talking about Deadpool, the ultra successful February release from Fox Studios, and making use of their license on Deadpool, a known kind of a tangential X character, I think would probably be the best way to describe him. His earliest introductions were in comics like New Mutants and X-Force.
Mm-hmm.
But
this is
the character of Deadpool made very popular in the 90s, and might be the perfect character to define that level of 90s comics, that type of 90s comics, and why that has not endured for us despite the success of this movie. Let's get into it, guys. What do we think about
Scott? I think you mentioning the studio is an important part of this story, because I think this movie is maybe saved Fox in the superhero game. Like, this is a sort of last ditch effort for them, where if this movie kind of tanked, at this point maybe they're thinking, all right, we're done with X-Men Apocalypse, we got one more Wolverine movie, maybe it's time to let Marvel take these guys back.
Yeah, maybe it's time for let Marvel offer us a boatload of money and we can take it and
right,
satisfaction.
But now they've made their own boatload of money.
Yes.
And I believe this is the highest grossing X film at this point in time.
I heard that
I might
too.
Be wrong about that, but I'm pretty sure that's correct.
Right. Well, I think that's correct.
Hopefully the next one might knock it out of the ballpark.
I'd be surprised if this one does better.
And I don't think it's going to.
Okay.
But that's a big deal. This is a big win for Fox. And it's a good thing for them, but it might be a bad thing for these characters and these movies going forward.
Yeah, I can see that. Also, on the other hand, I wonder is, I'd like to see my Marvel Universe as the Marvel Universe, but in the way things are going, do we need more clutter in the current Marvel Universe with this whole X continuity? It would be it'd be quite a logistical nightmare, one that I'd be interested in watching, but potentially, it might be worthwhile. But let's veer back a little towards the film itself. I enjoyed it. I saw it with you, John. I think we both kind of enjoyed it as a movie going experience. I think Kettner may have had a different experience, but even despite the fact that you were saying you enjoyed it, I think the existence of Deadpool seems slightly more odious to you than maybe to John and me.
Yeah, I was surprised that you guys saw it when you did. Like, when it came up, it was like, oh, we saw it. And I was like, whoa. Like, because I was not trying to see it. It's kind of funny because, like, in all the buildup of, or I guess the anticipation of the superhero movies this year, we've talked a lot of smack in advance of of BVSDOJ, but like Deadpool was just sort of like a non, it didn't even factor in. It's like, oh, I don't care. I don't care about Deadpool. I've never cared about him in the comics. I have, you know what I mean? I think that he has the worst fan base in comics. His fans are like the intersection of hockey jersey wearing like Kevin Smith fans, like the worst 90s stereotype of nerd. I feel like that's like the Deadpool fan base. And I was just like, you could be over there. And then it really was just the crazy cultural phenomenon of this movie, or just the fact that it was making such a splash and that you guys enjoyed it. And that I've heard a lot of other critics online that are just like, ah, it's a good time. Or, you know, they found it very refreshing. So I was like, okay, well, I can go check it out. And it was as good of a Deadpool movie as I guess I could expect. It was fine.
In our defense, John and I went on Valentine's Day together, so
it was a really nice date. Thank you, Scott.
In fact,
and thank you, Nina, for letting him. It was one of the funniest things I can recall,
where I said like, "Oh, it's Sunday night. I'm gonna go to bored." And I'm going to go to see the movies. It was like that cold weekend. And then I met John.
Scott, you could have just mentioned that it was President's Day pregame.
That's true.
Well, you could have went down that route, and I wouldn't have called you out on it.
The first thing you said to me is like, hey, thanks for taking me out on Valentine's Day when I ran into you on the street. I was like, oh, yeah, I'm a terrible husband. But I kept it real.
But a good friend.
I'm not I don't believe in consumerism for the love for my wife.
Hallmark holidays
every day
aren't for you, man.
Valentine's Day in my world. So just saying.
You got a lot of love to give.
Indeed.
But yeah, like Scott, I think for us, or at least for me, I had no interest in seeing this movie, but slowly but surely they did a really good job with the marketing, and it was kind of everywhere and you couldn't ignore it. I mean, I certainly couldn't ignore it because I just kept getting hit in the face with it wherever I looked. And it just seemed that like Ryan Reynolds was really into it and really happy about it. And I don't know, I think that excitement that he had or that was surrounding it, because they did a lot of social media stuff on this. There were a lot of cool billboards. Like, it just seemed like this movie was meant to just be a good time. Yeah. And nothing more. And nothing I certainly wasn't thinking, oh, I'm going to love Deadpool after this. My feelings about Deadpool are exactly the same after the movie as they were before. Like, not my thing. They did a really good job. He's fun. It's nice that he's around. I'm going to go party somewhere else now.
This is really sort of interesting, and I think it takes me back a little bit to our discussion about like breaking into comics a little while ago, in terms of how when we talk about like, oh, people who like superhero movies but don't read the comics, this is my first fucking window into that, where it's like, oh, I saw this superhero movie. I guess I would see another one, or I definitely wouldn't. I guess I wouldn't mind seeing Deadpool in an X-Men movie. I think a little bit of Deadpool goes a long way. That's my general feelings on the character. But I am not going to pick up a Deadpool comic. I still have zero interest in reading about it. And so now I sort of get why there's people who will see, you know, why the Avengers is like a mega hit, but how Avengers comics don't sell like gangbusters now.
Yeah, absolutely. And I definitely think that like... it was kind of nice to see a R-rated superhero movie, and regardless of how juvenile the humor was and how it was kind of nice to see like hard R-rated action to some extent, and a little bit of, and like even just like the, like just hearing like F-bombs dropped was just kind of like, it was kind of a novelty to some extent. Despite some of it, I definitely thought it was, the movie is even now convinced it was more clever and funny than I actually thought it was. Like, I like some of the characters involved. I like, you know, and I like TJ Miller. I think he's very talented and he had a few good zingers, but a lot of them kind of, a lot of the jokes were like a little on the nose and they fell a little flat for me, but I don't know. Like I it was okay.
Yeah, we got enough chuckles where there were actual chuckles.
I got some chuckles. I got some good fight some decent fight choreography thrills. I
got DMX.
I got some
so that
DMX
was awesome.
Which was well played. I definitely thought it was kind of like funny. John, were you the one who told me about the fact he kept on forgetting his guns was a budgetary issue.
Yeah, I learned that after the fact, that like right before Deadpool went into production, they had to slash somewhere between $7 to $8 million out of the budget, like really last minute. They're like, all right, if you want this movie made, it's going to be under $50 million or whatever it was. And they're like, okay, how are you going to do this? So they had a couple more action scenes that were supposed to be in there. There was supposed to be a big motorcycle chase. There was supposed to be some more shootouts. But basically, they were like, okay, he's going to use his swords a lot because that's going to save us money. So it became that sort of running joke of like, oh, he forgot his guns again. And I thought that was a really funny thing that, you know, worked out well. Like, hey, how are we going to get around this? Like, oh, we're going to make him forgetful.
That first action scene with the him counting the bullets was one of my favorite action scenes in the movie. And I agree with Scott. I think that one of the thing that really kept me interested was when it was full on like a 90s R-rated action movie, because that is something that we don't see. And it's a character that's appropriate to see that kind of just like action movie, like killing guys, you know, like, yeah. It was more like an action movie than a superhero movie. And just that excessiveness to the violence, or even like, I like when he cut his hand off, or like when he was like punching Colossus and just like wrecking his body. Like that part was fun.
Yeah. It's the great thing about this character is like, you don't care when he gets hurt. Like, you have you don't have enough vested interest in him to live or die, or it's like, oh yeah, he really got fucked up. That was pretty awesome.
He'll get better quickly, so it doesn't like, you know, it won't like him getting messed up in one scene won't make the next scene boring because he's like in a wheelchair.
Yeah, he's a mutant punching bag for action purposes. Like, that works. But Kat, you made a really good point. This was a movie of a character we know who he is, but we didn't go into the movie being like, oh, that's not how you're supposed to do Deadpool, or like, that's not the way that happened. Like, there was no preconceived, like, having to stick to continuity, or like, oh, I see how they like took these characters and smushed them together. It was all just like, hey, this is how the norms watch a superhero movie. And it was a nice experience.
Yeah, I mean, it had like it had that kind of like the problematic potentially a problematic portrayal of women, potentially like his relationship is seen as kind of strangely sweet, despite the fact that it like started as a sex trade situation. But hey, you know, I'm not judging. I'm just saying, like, it has a certain element of like,
you're judging a little. There's a little judging.
Maybe
there's a little judging.
It just kind of starts as like the, why are these characters in each other? Oh, they've got great chemistry and they like love each other really quickly in a year-round sex scene. And then like from that point on, like I was always just like, what does she do for a living now? Is she still a prostitute? And like, what's going on? Like, they just hang out in this like shitty apartment. Okay. It didn't matter. And like, that's the thing, is like, I think the movie tried to have like some heart, but it didn't really matter because you know, it's like, the weasel relationship or the blind owl relationship, like, you know, the Colossus relationship. Like, do we care about Deadpool's relationship? Like, do we care about his relationship with Francis? Do we enjoy the fact that we've got a British guy who continually says, say my name?
Oh, he was awful. Like, like, yeah, all of the guy. I was saying before we hit record that all of the flashback stuff, I was being reminded of Arrow, and I was like, I want to take a bathroom break. I don't need to see this like really cheap set of like a basement with like people on gurneys. Like, oh, this is straight out of the CW.
Like, it's a CW take on Jacob's Ladder.
This just in, I got an update from Fandango on my phone. It says Batman v Superman DOJ tickets on sale now.
Should we stop it now and we'll come back?
Don't miss this epic superhero battle they're informing. Okay.
Well, I hope not.
I think we can multitask. Someone get on buying none of those tickets. Zero. Put me down for a big zero on those.
I'm gonna see it. I've got to go. I've got plans.
I know you're gonna see it, and then you're gonna tell me everything that happens. So I don't have
to. Maybe an episode. Like, we just pitch an episode of like Scott tells us on the air about BBS DOJ.
Oh yeah, Scott, can you reenact it much like your brother reenacted Empire Strikes Back for you as a child? Because that would be awesome.
Okay, here's the key. You've got to watch me go in super slow motion, then super fast motion repeatedly. You're gonna love
it. I actually love this idea for an episode. I'm gonna come back to this.
Okay. So so here we go. We saw Deadpool. In many ways, it had like a lot of traditional comic book elements, which we really didn't get into. It had an origin story, had a revenge plot, it had a hero has to save the girl plot. But it also had all these like extreme moments and hyper violence, and had a big potty mouth, and had a kind of a juvenile sense of humor. And that's kind of 90s comics in a nutshell, right? Like it in many ways, it carried on the same spandex and superpower kind of traditions, but it had this edgy, violent, grim, ridiculousness to it. And, you know, we should talk a little bit about how Rob Liefeld made that happen. Rob Liefeld.
Before the man we shall not name on this podcast, there was Rob Liefeld.
that's kind of true.
So, it's like someone has taken that monster's mantle away from him. And actually, at this point, the pendulum is swinging back around. What with Deadpool's success, it's like, well, I guess Rob's not as bad as that other guy.
Yeah. Have you noticed that Rob Liefeld's been doing a lot of victory laps recently and talking a lot of shit. Let's just mention who Rob Liefeld is for those who don't know.
Who doesn't wear Levi's 501 jeans?
I was going to say, we got to talk about the 501 jeans commercial. The Rob is a 90s comic book artist who rose to fame, who gained fame working on the New Mutants. Sort of hijacked that book from Louise Simonson, a pretty respected writer in the business, and gave everyone pouches and remade the team of like coming of age mutant story as a paramilitary group led by Arnold Schwarzenegger. I mean, Cable.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Rob Liefeld's signature style. you mentioned before he had this kind of like superhero militaristic aesthetic that he seemed to be pushing for. So every character had like bandoliers and
shoulder pads
and shoulder armor and like pouches and like ammo clips and
guns that were square
that had like slot shaped barrels, guns that were just basically like metal tubes with no real like trigger or handle mechanism, because they were easier to draw. And I think the most important thing is that Rob had a creative take on his expression of, I'm going to say human in quotes, of human anatomy, because he drew in a dynamic style that couldn't be bothered to make people look like people.
Kendra, you're the artist in this group. Can you put this in sort of like terms about what he does and how he does it wrong?
I would be here all day. Here's the thing, is like there's something that can be said for a stylistic approach to superhero art, and I've heard some Rob defenders even compare his work to Jack Kirby. You know, or which is sacrilege, I know, but it's the Sorry. It's a sort of thing where it's very expressive, and it's just so much of what it is. And sometimes there's cartoonists who take shortcuts. Like Rob's work is lazy. It's like I feel like defenders would be like, oh, it's a stylistic choice, and it's in some ways the style does fit the content of what he's going for, but it doesn't make it any better. there's just a complete disregard for anatomy. I don't think he's a good storyteller. He doesn't draw backgrounds. It just goes on and on and on.
He doesn't draw feet. There's no feet in his comics.
No, I know. Right. I mean, like
they're super tiny.
Yeah, it's troubling. I mean, and the thing is, like, you can take some of those elements and be like, well, you know what? Mignola didn't really draw feet in a lot of his old stuff, but he's a much more competent artist. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah.
And it's like one of those things that, like, if you don't know what you're looking at, like, you can maybe not see a distinction. But yeah, he was a blight. He was a blight on comics. And the worst thing about him is, like, he influenced other people to draw like him. And that's really, like, the real shame is that
point in time, he had the largest selling comic book ever when X-Force 1 came out. And that was just for until the new X-Men book that Jim Lee was on came out. But like for a time, Rob Liefeld was the biggest name in comics. And you put his name on a comic and it sold like nobody's business.
And he, you know, and he, you know, and I think my least favorite thing about Rob Liefeld is take all his anatomy, his lack of backgrounds. He makes people have these like, the squinty, like angry face that he is can show no expression except for like shouting rage, and he just all his characters look like assholes. like they don't look like people I want to hang out with. They look like a bunch of douchebags.
Do you want to hang out with Rob Liefeld? Does he look like someone you want to hang out with?
I don't know. I've never met him.
You've seen him.
Yes, I have. No, I don't want to hang out with him. I do. I definitely, you know, you hear things about him like, oh, he's a nice guy. But then you realize he's like, he's got a huge ego. He shits on people who are more talented than he is. He monetizes and commodifies his talent using his popularity and being the right guy at the right place at the right time as proof of his worth. There's a sad kind of, you know, I don't like to shit on people here and I don't know him. So but he's, he's a terrible artist who has made my life worse. So I'm going to take a little carte blanche and like going after him a little bit. But then again, he's a terrible artist whose amusement at how terrible he is in many ways made my life better. So maybe I should take that stance.
Is he kind of like an Ed Wood?
Making fun of Rob Liefeld is it's shooting fish in a barrel, but it is certainly a it's a comical time.
You know, it's funny. At that time when I was reading comics and air quoting collecting comics, I was buying stuff that I thought also would, you know, would be putting my future children through college, oddly enough. And that was not the era to be doing that, because that was the era of excess. It's sad that I think the most valuable comic I do own now is his New Mutants number 98, which is the first appearance of Deadpool. I'm just like, oh, that's it? That's the most valuable comic I own from close to 30 years of collecting?
Sell it now.
That's kind of sick. Yeah.
You should sell that shit right now.
And make like $50. Great.
And make $50. You know what? It's better than having a Rob Liefeld comic in your collection, having $50.
Take yourself out to dinner. Like, sell that comic.
I don't know. I don't know, Scott. Having Rob Liefeld comics make all the other comics seem that much better.
That's true. I guess so. I guess it's... But that's like... That is a fake... inflation of their value.
Yeah.
You know, like, right. It's like, that's not a way to go. But okay, so Rob Liefeld is this patron saint of shitty 90s excess comics with, you know,
and it,
like terrible characterization, shitty storytelling, crappy action.
And the guy's stuck around. Like, you can't get rid of this guy. Right. He's still here. He's still doing the same stuff.
In style over substance, which I think is like a big thing if we want to talk about that sort of trend of 90s comics, is that everything, I feel like writers just got like ousted from their jobs, and basically people who had like the style of the moment, they got elevated so much that they were directing the course of a company and taking over books. And you had people like Liefeld and McFarlane and Jim Lee like basically kicking out Chris Claremont to do an X-Men book that he bailed on after like a couple months. You know, there was that whole, like these guys that like represented the style of the 90s, like took over and then dropped the ball and did their own thing and then dropped that ball.
Yes. So let's talk about that. That would be the formation of Image Comics, right? Where like some of the biggest artistic, the hottest and biggest artistic talents, and so I say some of that in quotes, but is that some others not, went and made their own comic book company because they were sick of having to work for a wage and give all their money to Marvel. They thought they could, that they were the appeal of the comics they were creating and wanted to profit from that appeal directly, which in some ways it's not that wrong an idea. You know, if you feel like you're being exploited by a company which is known to take advantage of creative people, and you think that you're big enough you could do it on your own, I applaud that kind of
great move,
that angle.
Absolutely. That's a great smart move.
The problem was they're not very good at crafting stories to match their artistic style, like you said. So there was no substance. And I think another thing that's really worth noting is that they made these Image Comics, this handful of artists, and they were not very professional about meeting the deadlines, because since they were no longer working for the man, they no longer had to listen to the man about getting paid. pages in on time.
Staying on deadline,
And meeting their deadlines, because they weren't going to fire themselves. They weren't they were the CEO and the talent. So they got really behind, and I think that was the biggest problem with them. Like, their comics weren't very good, and people were probably going to figure that out at some point or another. But if they had come out more often, I mean, if you go to a comic book shop every week and the book you really want keeps not coming out, you're going to start picking up the comics that are coming out. And
I'm still waiting for Pit number 2 to come out, man.
I was just thinking of Pit.
Like, I'm still waiting for Battle Chasers to finish.
Well, do we want to?
It's later on, I know.
Do we like want to talk about that wave of books, and which, if any, we read, and which, in what order did we stop reading them? Is that a conversation worth having?
I think so, and I'll be the first to admit I read them all. I bought all that Image stuff. Again, mostly because I thought, hey, this stuff might accrue in value at some point. And they were like, even at that time, I was like, these are hard to read. Nothing's happening. Why does this make no sense?
Yeah. I remember
why do all these characters look like X-Men when they're not X-Men?
Should we hit the major guys and their flagship titles?
Sure.
We've got your aforementioned Rob Liefeld, who brought us a book called Young Blood. Not to be confused with the 80s hockey movie.
maybe it should be confused with the 80s hockey movie.
Yeah, maybe. We have Todd McFarlane, who jumped from his own Spider-Man title to Spawn, which is still going today. Jim Lee, who jumped from X-Men to do a book called Wildcats. Cats, an acronym for covert action teams. And who else? Eric Larson, another Spider-Man artist, who has his own book called The Savage Dragon, which is still going today. Hats off to him. And then two more kind of randos.
Will Spertassi?
Mark Silvestri.
Yeah, go for it.
Mark Silvestri, who was an artist who was on X-Men, and then he was drawing Wolverine, and was just kind of okay. And Jim Valentino, who was drawing Guardians of the Galaxy, which wasn't a particularly popular Marvel book, and he wasn't a particularly good artist. But somehow, I guess he was buddies with them. Got in there. Am I leaving anyone out? I see Will Portacio's name up here, but I don't remember him being one of the originals.
Was Dale Keown one of the originals?
No, he was not.
He was second wave.
Second wave. Okay.
And
the Hulk artist, right?
There was that, and like, yeah, he was a Hulk artist, and then there was Sam Keith, who was second wave, and yeah, like.
Yeah, I think Will Portacio was the seventh one, and he was the one who failed more than any of those guys, because he never put anything out.
And pretty soon, like, I was all in. I was interested. I remember Young Blood, when that was announced, I remember it was like, I think it was an issue of Comic Scene, that like pre-Wizard magazine, came out when I was in eighth grade, and it was basically like an interview with the Rob and like Young Blood character designs, and I was interested. I was interested in the idea of a new universe, and that's something that I think is another conversation, just about like the appeal of like a fresh universe for superhero stories. And at the time, you know, Image was sort of exciting. It was like, oh, sure, you want to try it out. But it lost its luster pretty fast. Like, I remember really wanting to like them and giving up really early on most of those books, on most of them.
You know, it's funny, though, like, in a lot of ways, those books gave up on you. Like, it was kind of that idea of like, hey, I'm still waiting for like the new Spawn. And then like a couple months pass and you're like, you know what? Never mind. You know, like they're.
In defense of Spawn, which I can't believe I just said, that was one of the few books that actually mostly came out on time.
True. I guess there are worse offenders. Spawn's the only one I actually read past like issue 5. And that's probably.
I have way too many issues of Spawn still in my. I think I'm up to like 20. Oof. I think I got 20 issues.
McFarlane also was one of the only ones early on to be like, hey, Neil Gaiman, hey, Frank Miller, do you guys want to write an issue of this? And delegated to people who are much better writers than him.
Yeah, and eventually he picked much, like, you know, he stopped drawing it too. And then you know, relatively early on, like he was, you know, too busy making action figures or something.
Yeah, I sort of feel bad for Greg Capullo for Greg Capullo drawing Spawn for all those years, where I could have been seeing Greg Capullo draw comics that I like, as the recent Batman run has been like, oh, Greg Capullo, he's good.
You were like saying, I remember when I was like, oh, I should get back into like reading comics, and you're like, oh, this Batman's pretty good, and I was like, Scott Snyder, wait, Greg Capullo, like, didn't he like draw Spawn forever? And I was like, ugh, and then I was like, oh, maybe he's good. But I remember being like, Greg Capullo, that's okay, I can do with that.
So Image Comics was, again, a perfect name for the perfect company at the perfect time. Was all about 90s largesse. Like, it was big, in your face, collector driven, no, all style, no substance, and it lasted for a while, and it had such a effect on the big two, Marvel and DC, that they started changing what they did,
right,
and their titles followed
suit. It broke comics.
And
that was, it almost broke comics.
You know, they were super. I'm sorry. Go on.
Oh, I was just gonna say that it almost broke comics. Like that trend broke comics. It pushed everything to their furthest extremes, right? So you had like the Image trend, and then it was like the loss of those creators of the big two, and then the big two chasing those trends, and then the response in like the indie / Vertigo community, right? Like so you had another end of the comics industry going in a completely different way, and it was dark days. It was dark days for comics.
It was also death of comics. Maybe, but definitely like it was a because there, you know, it inspired lots of other interesting comics to come out at the same time, which we can get into, but it was almost really the death of the superhero in my mind, because all these teams, like the thing that they were about them was like they were either like murderous vigilantes or like quasi military teams. You know, there's a lot of like covert action and guys like jumping out of like hover ships or helicopters and like landing and like destroying guys. Like they were like, these were all like military dudes or like, you know, or former military turned cyborg / mutant / whatever type things. But like everyone was part of like a crack team of murderous assholes. And you know, like in a way, like that was the thing, is like, they were all like, we're the best at what we do. We're like silent killers. And they were like, there was like a lack of fun. Like these characters weren't like, there was a lack of characterization. There was a certain like sleaziness to them as well. Like I remember there was like this, like the idea of like these characters, like they don't like, they're not like Boy Scouts. They're like, they'll like bang chicks and like kill dudes and like, you know, and whatever it takes, because they can't be held in by the morality of like a normal person. They're like super badass.
Yeah.
And so that element was like the biggest turnoff, besides the horrible art and the terrible stories, was the kind of just like, these characters were fucking assholes.
I want to say that they chased the kids out of the comic book store too.
I would say that's right. I mean, like they chased the childhood out of kids. You know, like
that's
there
true.
Was no kind of like, there's no joy of a super, like, I remember like when Todd McFarlane talking about Spawn was like, Spawn's like so much better than Batman, because like Spawn like kills guys instead of like Batman, who's like a pussy basically. And like, you know, like, and Spawn's black. And so and Batman's just some rich white guy. And I'm like, a rich white guy like you, Todd McFarlane?
Yeah, the progressivism of Spawn. Oh my gosh. Yeah, and so this is an interesting thing when we were talking about, if we were basically talking about the 90s coming back, and if Deadpool represents the 90s comic book aesthetic or take on superheroes coming back into the mainstream for superhero movies, and how scary that is a month out from BVS DOJ. Tickets on sale now. You know, because it basically, like Scott, what you just said is like that whole dialogue of like it's like Superman's such a fucking Boy Scout, someone's got to show him like what it really takes to be a hero. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like that
killing Zod. Oh wait, no, he did that.
Yeah, like,
oh,
like,
yeah.
Yeah, but he like cried about it like a fucking like baby. Yeah. Like that whole idea, like that meme, that cultural shift like that's happening now in the movies, and that like Deadpool somehow as a movie did it in a way that I didn't find like so offensive, because it was having fun with it. It didn't take itself seriously, but that makes it a little bit easier to take than seeing those same trends come back and be self-serious about it. I think in comics, the newest example of that is things like in like the New 52. Basically, this current iteration of the DC universe seems very much modeled on 90s Image / Marvel trends.
That's probably why I'm not interested in it.
Yeah.
I'll pop in here and say something about the Deadpool we saw in the movie. The Deadpool we saw in the movie is not the Rob Liefeld.
Yeah, yeah, I wanted to make that point.
It's too. Not. It is not that version of it. It's not the extreme awful version of it. It's a version that maybe we don't like as much as our regular guys, but it's a better version than that original.
Well, I think
and I think that he's part. Some of this 90s stuff coming back is actually fixing those awful characters from the 90s, and a lot of them were Liefeld properties, oddly enough. So oddly, give credit to Rob Liefeld. He made some stuff that people over time have made better. Well, and taken his stink off of it.
Yeah, I think that's
created things that are okay.
That's an excellent
point. Not great, not awesome, not even things we like, but things that are like better, improved.
I think this Deadpool is based very much on the like the more of the aughts Deadpool, mm-hmm. you know.
Yes.
And the Joe Kelly and Ed McGuinness take on that character, and that character is almost a joke about 90s tropes, mm-hmm. because it's kind of like almost like the Deadpool of that is this like, you know, fourth wall breaking kind of insane guy who's aware that he's in a comic book, kind of. That's like the conceit they go with a lot, and the concept is like he's got swords and guns, but he's like a weird relic from the 90s who's trying to like play in the modern continuity, which is a lot more classic, and he stands out for that reason, and he's kind of like he's so absurd because that time was so absurd, but he's like the only guy who's absurd like that. Like he's this kind of relic from the 90s, and that's what's really funny about him. Like, I mean, if you look at it, like everyone's kind of like tried to fix Cable and tried to fix Domino or tried to, you know, Psylocke. They're these characters who have had like runs where they're just trying to sort of these really iconic 90s type characters who've like have been trying to give in something to do in the last 15 years that they weren't doing in the 90s. But like Deadpool is still just like the dumb merc with the mouth who's like still pretty much the exact same design that as he did when he was first created, and that's ridiculous, and it's played for ridiculousness, not for cool, or ridiculousness and cool, which is, you know, which is certainly a more palatable combination than cool and badass, you know.
Yeah, but like, but do you think that the financial success of the movie? Do you think that studio heads are going to be able to make that distinction as well or as poorly as comics editors and executives did in the 90s?
Well, I don't know. I feel like for better or for worse, Ryan Reynolds has a good idea of what he wants with the character, and I like his version more than I can imagine liking other versions. And I think, you know, he's going to have some level of, I'm going to get to portray that. I'm never going to let this character get portrayed poorly again, like I did in like the X-Men Origins movie. Like he's dedicated to making this Deadpool the Deadpool, regardless if you like it or not. I like it better than I thought I would, and I like it better than other versions I can imagine. So I'm not too worried about like Deadpool changing to something worse, because people love meta bullshit anyway. You know, they love being in on jokes and Easter eggs and whatnot, and that's what all this shit's about.
You know, I think it is opening up the superhero genre, even though it's not opening maybe doors or windows that we want to walk through or stick our head into, much like what DC does with their line of movies, which we kind of don't dig. The fact that we don't dig them doesn't really matter. We have the movies we like, and these movies are for different audience.
It would suck.
And that's kind of cool that the audience, in a way, is wide enough that it can sustain that.
Yeah.
For a time. Now, it's not going to last. You know, when I hear that maybe the third Wolverine movie is going to be R, that's when I'm like, maybe? If done right, it could be yeah, cool.
It could be an interesting take.
But we know this character is a PG-13 character. So is there just going to be like a lot of decapitations? Is there going to be excess violence that we haven't seen before that I don't think anyone's really... We've seen Wolverine. We've known Wolverine for 15 years now, basically. Like, I don't think anyone's been like, oh, God, I wish Wolverine would just, like, cut up some more dudes.
You know what? I agree with you on some extent. Like, people kind of like him, like, kind of waving his claws at guys and guys kind of falling down and not really worrying about it. But I remember there was, like, a weird satisfaction in X2 when he's in the house and, like, those, like, weird, like, striker, like, SWAT team show up. And then, like, the guy comes and he, like, grabs him and he just, like, stabs him in the chest. And there's this moment of, like, he, like, puts him against the wall and, like, puts his blades into him. And he's, like, it pauses for a second and you're, like, yeah, that just happened. You know, like, there's this moment of, like, Wolverine just, like, killed a dude who was attacking the mansion, and there was a certain, like, kind of grim satisfaction in that moment, as I recall. So I kind of, like, I could see people
right,
really
but
wanting
and,
to see
and it. It was handled in a very effective way.
Because the violence felt real.
Like, it wasn't gratuitous.
There was no blood in that moment, but there was, like, death, and that was kind of that was the key, is that
it
gets silly.
And in those original movies, like, Wolverine is set apart from the rest of the X-Men in a way that it's getting increasingly blurry, as even evidenced in the Deadpool movie, where it's like, oh yeah, Colossus is more of a goody two-shoes, but he's not, like, at all distressed that Deadpool is killed, like, a ton of... It's like, Deadpool, you should not do this, my friend, Tovarish!
I'm so disappointed, and this is so gross.
Tovarish.
Like, yeah. Like, he's, like, taking Deadpool in to, like, make him an X-Men, not to, like, send him to prison.
yeah, so...
You know? Which is what where killers should go.
Yeah, so it's a little weird, and, like, and yeah, like, Deadpool was fine, and I don't really have beef with it as a movie, but I am a little nervous about seeing the 90s, that trend mirror itself in the movies. And John, like we were saying, it's like, yeah, like, variety isn't bad, and certain comics projects can be appropriate with an R rating. I just worry about studios chasing Deadpool money, and, like, that is... Because that's what the comic companies did. They were just chasing the money.
But here's the thing, Marvel and Disney will never do that because it's Disney. Disney's not going to make an R-rated superhero movie. Like, the cool thing is your Marvel movies are fine.
You think that brand is safe?
And they're not. That brand is totally safe because it's a Disney brand.
Safe for now.
They know that making an R movie is not going to make them as much money as they think it is.
Toys and merchandising. Like, for every, like, mainstream Marvel thing.
Yeah, I'm going to tell you that the Deadpool money is... There's going to be very little Deadpool money outside the movie. Like, you're not going to see a ton of Deadpool toys in Toys R Us with little kids playing. What
about... I don't know. Deadpool might host Saturday Night Live. Yeah.
Yeah, because that would work.
You mean a CG mask won't work well on live TV? I don't believe it.
I will say that's... Aside from the violence, my other favorite thing was the mask. It was like, oh, they beat Spider-Man to doing exactly what a Spider-Man mask should be in a movie. Like, a very expressive superhero mask.
Yeah, expressive eyes moving inexplicably. I think is that the first time we've seen, like, the white Batman eyes in a mask. Movie?
Mm-hmm.
Like, in a mask?
I think so.
And also, it's just kind of that weren't glowing or explained, just, like, that's how it worked. It was kind of cool. I think that... Deadpool is probably, like, for better or for worse, like, Rob Liefeld's one of his better designs, probably because it's, like, a ripoff of something between, like, it's a combination
Spider-Man
of
Spider-Man and Snake Eyes.
Spider-Man and exactly. I mean, like, it's pretty obvious.
Spider-Man, Snake Eyes, Deathstroke, Wolverine, all of them.
It's like, hey, it's like you've got that going for you, and then hey, let's add some, like, you know, you got Deathstroke meets Spider-Man meets, you know, all that stuff. And the pouches, while excessive, at least, like, he's carrying a lot of weapons, so he would need something for his ammunition. The versus, like, a guy who's maybe wearing a spider suit but with, like, a sleeveless, you know, hoodie and according to Wizard, pouches on his ankles for his fruit roll-ups.
Yeah.
Great joke.
Go fruit roll-ups. I think it's weird that, like, so we've had violent R-rated superhero movies in the form of Kick-Ass, which the first one did well. I don't know how the second one did. I don't think it did so hot, much like the second Sin City movie didn't do so hot. But, you know, it's like, should those movies have come out too soon? in this sort of like world of superheroes. Is that idea of that R-rated superhero too early at that time for like audiences to really enjoy and understand? What is it about Deadpool, which isn't, I guess, that much different from Kick-Ass, other than the fact that it's rooted in a Marvel property? Like, what did Deadpool have that these other movies didn't have?
I think it had superpowers. It had a certain bombastic element to it that made more sense than like Hit Girl for all of her popularity. It was kind of like, it made you feel less gross for some reason. I feel pretty gross.
It kind of did, you know. It's weird. They're both violent R-rated superhero movies, but I didn't feel like terribly like itchy.
Yeah, I felt pretty
after
grossed
seeing
out
Deadpool.
Watching Kick-Ass, and I saw Kick-Ass 2 not in the theater, but later on, and I was even doubly squicked out by it.
Yeah,
And it's kind of funny to like to put your finger on it, like what it is, but it's kind of like that thing with like Wanted too. You know,
yeah.
It's like, yeah, this is a bleak, like, you know, you're kind of like, you're like, oh, this is why people hate like teenagers.
Yeah.
Or like hate like teenage.
That Mark Millar stank. That, yeah. Mark Millar like riffing on the 90s stank, which is, yeah, is maybe even worse. I'll give credit to Ryan Reynolds in a very Robert Downey Jr. like a charisma effect of making it, you know, making it watchable in a way that, yeah, maybe it wouldn't be, you know. He's, say what you will about the guy, but he's more charismatic than Quicksilver, who's the Kick-Ass kid, who's fine. Like, but
no, and remember, it's not the good Quicksilver that's in the X-Men universe, it's the bad Quicksilver that's in the Avengers universe.
Hey, he's fine, he's Russian, he's dead, we're good.
But I mean, like, when you get Evan Peters as Quicksilver, who's like really entertaining, yeah, and funny. You
also
know,
the idea of like, I can imagine Kettner being like, oh man, like Kick-Ass had to die, so, but he had to save Renner. Like, why couldn't they both die? Even though I'm a Renner apologist, and not apologist, I'm a fan. I'm a fan of the Renner. I'll give Renner, Renner gets my money any day. Yeah, that's right.
Wow.
I like his little squishy face.
Not my Clint Barton.
No, that's true. He's more of the, he's like an ultimate Clint Barton. It's just, it's a bad, like, he's fine. It's just, he's just a bad, he's not a great version of that character. Like, they should have, that character had been, they should have done a better job of waiting for that character to come around to make him compelling before you stuck a guy in that suit.
Yeah.
So be it. But let's get back to the 90s, and let's take we've got about 15 minutes left or so. So maybe we should talk a little bit about the,
I think something in
the 90s that were good, the kind of the yang to the excess yin. Some of my very favorite comics came out in the 90s as well, and as almost kind of a direct statement against the imagization, the 90s imagization of comics. Like, so let's get into that a little bit. Let's talk, can we start with Vertigo maybe?
Scott, I thought you were talking specifically about the Dark Horse Legends line, which seemed very much like it was the 80s,
yeah,
hard hitters jumping off,
yeah,
instead of the 90s.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And they were doing kind of a lot of their still 80s thing. You know, some
Danger
of those
Unlimited.
Were very hit and miss too. Danger Unlimited. You know, who went there? It was Byrne. It was Mignola. It was Art, mm-hmm, Adams. Trying to think of, do you guys
did
know
Starlin,
off the top of your head?
Did Starlin what bring that other... or was that Bravura?
Bravura! Oh, yes, we got a Bravura reference. Thank you, Kat.
Breed? Yeah, there's, oh, shit.
And again, this is something we forgot to really highlight. Like, this was a time where now all these comic book labels were popping up. So, like, if you got, like, a team of, like, four or five dudes who knew how to make comics, like, you could start, yeah, your own comic company.
Or imprint.
I mean, Neil Gaiman had his own comic label at some point with some really awful books, but...
But, like, yeah, there was a lot of, like, weird license. Like, I mean, Dark Horse was, like, the licensed comic guys, but then they started making stuff like... Remember, I mean, Kettner and I were at a Comic-Con, I think, in Philly, when there was, like, a panel about, like, Legend Comics was going to be an imprint that went across multiple companies before that stopped.
Mm-hmm.
But there was, like, the idea of, like, oh, we're going to put this, like, you know, Easter Island head on, like, you know, different comics, and that'll be, like, just demonstrating this kind of creator-owned Maverick look, and that's where, you know, Hellboy came from. That,
yep.
Who could forget Monkey Man and O'Brien?
Oh, yeah. Oh, here's some other big names on there. Mike Allred, mm-hmm. Paul Chadwick, Dave Gibbons, Jeff Darrow, Walt Simonson.
Yeah, brought back Star Slammers. Yeah, books. Yeah, it was, and those are all some of my favorite creators. That there, it wasn't all of their best work, but it was definitely something that I ended up gravitating to way more than Image. I was an Image hater. Like I drank the Kool-Aid and then spat it out, and I sort of quickly sort of realized, I was like, oh, I like the people who tell better stories, and then I was very quick to try and support those creators in their work.
So we had that stuff. We had like stuff like Dark Horse putting out some really interesting, not even superhero stuff necessarily, a lot of horror, pulp horror combinations, different takes on story on big characters.
Scott, all those Grendel books that you love so much.
All those Grendel books I love so much, you know, like the Mike Allred Madman stuff, like so amazing, like a revelation for me. Like that, the excess, I was in on it, but like I think the mid 90s kind of Dark Horse and some of the Vertigo work, which was an imprint of DC, for those who don't know, that had more of like adult or out there, alternative. It was kind of like grunge music for in comics. It was this kind of...
Well, look at it this way. To give a quick explanation, DC took a couple of their established characters and basically excised them from the DC universe proper because they wanted to tell more mature stories with them. So you had characters like Swamp Thing and you had John Constantine. Those seem to be like the two big Vertigo beginner books. And Sandman. Which, again, began rooted in the DC universe, but then they sort of took it away. And I think they were smart because they saw they had a superstar in Neil Gaiman, and they really attacked. They let him run roughshod over that label. And it was good. It turned out great.
There was this counter, like it kind of the counter action against the comics I hated in the 90s kind of entered into, I like to think of as like a... for me personally, like a little mini golden age of comics, like when I was just really excited about comics, I wanted to make comics. I wanted to live comics all the time. Say we were about the 90s, the comics I read in the 90s made me a lifelong comic fan. It really like elevated my enjoyment of the craft. Like I said, like, you know, like you talk about Grendel, you talk about like Hellboy, like these are comics that I'm like, you know, that changed how I viewed that.
You know what, guys, I think it's really interesting because we're talking about, we spent a lot of time talking about how much some of these trends and in how dark a period it was, but how we found the stuff. I think it, you know, we're talking about the decade and it sort of resonates in some of the conversations we've had over the past couple of weeks with music and whatnot, is that because there was so much bullshit, we were sort of forced to be discerning readers and consumers and to look for the good shit. You know, we had to find our taste. It wasn't just, oh, well, these are the comics that were coming out. Like maybe in 1987, there was only like, you know, Marvel and DC would be the only books we were exposed to. And like we, you know, read whatever, but in the 90s we were exposed to more. There was a lot of bad stuff. And so we had to really, if we were interested and we had to find the good stuff. And that level of engagement, I think, is something that is a positive thing that came out of like all that excess.
Yeah. It's a silver lining for sure. So we're getting, you know, towards the end of this episode. I feel remiss that we didn't at least give Valiant more of a discussion, which was another alternative, large shared universe, you know, comic book company.
I think we should have like an episode devoted to those other universes. Like Valiant is maybe one of the most cohesive ones, but I think that we could do a whole episode about like the superhero universe that isn't Marvel or DC, that is like a line, because there's not that many of them.
Okay.
Yeah. No, and some are coming back. And I think some other episode we need to do at some point is, you know, we talked a lot about Image Comics, and maybe this is an introduction to Image for a lot of people. Image today might be our favorite comic book company.
Absolutely.
And it's so funny that that's a thing. Like it's funny that they're still around. You know, at one point it really seemed creators started jumping ship. Some went back to Marvel. Others went on to work for DC. And it just seemed to be another rudderless imprint that was going to go out to pasture. But somehow it stuck around. And, you know, we were looking at their Wikipedia page, and like Robert Kirkman was a big part of that. Now, I'm not a big Kirkman fan. I don't love him. I don't hate him. But like, he seemed to be a turning point for the company. And now that's the company that produces the best comic books consistently. And they're the ones I think we're all interested in reading. And they're the ones where we always give sort of a, hey, they've got a new book out. I'm going to check that out. I might, you know, Wicked and Divine's out. I checked it out. I didn't like it. I moved on because another cool new book's coming out. That's the kind of like work they do now. And it's really cool. So I think we'll have an Image part two.
Yeah.
The return episode coming up pretty soon.
So at this point though, let's talk about, let's get into that elevator. We haven't done that in a long time. And I think it's time to do the pitch that will make us all rich. Rich as Nazis.
Whoa, Mr. Burns.
I'm quoting The Simpsons. It's fine. It's fair game.
Oh,
it's fine.
Okay.
Look it up on the Frinkiax.
So it is once again time for elevator action.
Elevator going up. In the gleaming corridor of the 51st floor, the money can be
made. Okay, John, I'm putting you on the spot. I want you in this elevator first. A, because you wisely made this a 90s comics, not a 90s property, so I've had to pivot.
Sorry I ruined your White Wolf, whatever thing you were going to do that I probably wouldn't have understood. Fair enough. Anyway.
I got a new one, and it's going to be terrible.
So I mentioned this. All right, I'm getting into the elevator. I'm pressing up. I got a minute to sell you on this. I mentioned this to you guys the other day, and it's funny. We were just ending this conversation talking about other universes out there. There was another 90s universe out there called the Ultraverse. It was a series of books. I never read a single Ultraverse book. Not a one. I know nothing about it other than I know the characters' names and what they look like. Marvel, again, in that weird 90s period, eventually bought that universe and somehow swung it into the Marvel universe. I know there's some crossover with Thor at some point. Anyway, this property is in some weird legal limbo, which always fascinates me. I love how like these characters sort of get lost along the way when companies go out of business. And, you know, we've seen it with Marvel Man or Miracle Man and how long it takes for you to, you know, get back to this. But I'd like to see what a creator can do if given sort of an established universe with a bunch of characters and just being like, go run roughshod over this. Go do a superhero universe. Here's some ideas. Keep what you want. Kick out what you don't want. Make it fun. Make it cool. And I think we've seen with the return of Valiant and maybe even sort of the return of, you know, people working on some awful Liefeld properties from the 90s, whether it was Profit or Glory, and turning these characters into like new readable books in the 21st century. So instead of just giving a property or two, here, take an entire universe under the auspices of Marvel and just go nuts. Maybe it's another new universe.
What creators would you pitch, John?
Oh, I mean, wow, I didn't even think that far. I couldn't tell you right now, honestly. You know, maybe it's a place for new young creators to come in, you know, giving guys their first go at something, or, you know, get a mix of talent. You know, we're always looking for, and DC tries to push this but never actually does, you know, we're looking for diverse talent in this industry that's not too diverse, you know. So like, make this a place for opportunity for people who you might not normally look to tell some stories. So that's my pitch.
Ding ding, I'm in. It's just like, oh, we can buy this property and we can make a lot of money. You know, like stranger things have happened. I think executives could get behind that. It's very low risk, high reward. How about you, Kat? What are you thinking? Or do you want me to go?
No, I got it. I was thinking about when we were talking about a bright spot in the 90s during those dark days, one of our favorite characters, and especially me and John, was Jack Knight, Starman. And I think that this is a character that really should have the opportunity to outlive its creator, in much in the same way that people were sort of hands-off on Morpheus after Neil Gaiman left Sandman. People basically dropped the Jack Knight character from the DC universe, even though he's pretty interesting and pretty compelling. And much like Deadpool or any one of dozens of characters that we could name, you know, sometimes it really would just take like another creator with a fresh take to give that character a legacy outside of its singular creator. And Jack Knight is a sort of reluctant superhero. He has tons of 90s-isms. He's like got tattoos and a leather jacket and goggles. He's like a...
Sometimes a goatee.
Yeah, like he's very much the prototypical quote-unquote hipster superhero. He was an antique dealer. He had like superhero dad. And there was a lot of interesting relationship dynamics in that book, but he's just a character that I want to see survive the 90s. You know, he's way more deserving of that shot than Deadpool is, in my opinion. And yeah, like, I guess I would like to see him sort of re-embraced by a hopefully rebooted DC universe. And yeah, give us a Jack Knight book. And kind of what you were saying, John, I'd like to see like a pretty fresh creator. And the guy that's coming to mind is Michelle Fife, who does that book Copra, which is it basically started out as like Suicide Squad fan fiction, but he writes and draws it, and it has a very spontaneous look and feel to it. But I sort of feel that he has like enough of its own like off-kilter sensibility that would benefit the character, and it wouldn't look at all like Tony Harris. And so I think it would be a creator with his own sort of unique take, a character that sort of allows for that amount of leeway or a diversity of approach, that it would be okay that it didn't look like a traditional superhero story. And yeah, just like reintroduce this character for a new generation and make him like, you know, your Superman, your Batman, like every character that gets reinvented and gets the benefit of being rejuvenated by a new set of eyes and a new set of hands.
You know, it's funny how like Stargirl was supposed to be that the passing off of him.
And then they didn't do anything with her. She was cool. Like,
yeah, and then like she's around. She's on, I see her on teams, but I don't think she ever sort of got the push that she deserved.
Yeah, there's like kind of like where like the Starman thing got kind of pulled into like the Justice Society of that kind of that earthier,
right,
more earthbound, you know, superhero team, yeah, despite the fact that they had like they're just as powerful and had all like this JLA elements, but like they're kind of like this kind of like hominess to them, and she like I feel like that was like the final destination for a lot of those types of characters.
Well, yeah, it's the whole notion of legacy in the DC universe that got axed by the New 52, but that's another complaint.
That's a whole nother
thing. What do you got, Brown?
John, yeah, okay, Scotty, what
so
do you
this
have?
This is a pitch. I'm going to get back in with those DC guys that you just got out from, and they're like, you know, you can do this. It's one direction to go, but I'm going to say, hey, guys, you've got your Suicide Squad. It's got some buzz coming about that, kind of a darker and lighter look at the superhero genre, and I think it's getting some steam, and there might be some appeal there. You're looking at stuff like Deadpool, so I'd say take some Suicide Squad, like rooting for the bad guy. Take some Deadpool, a little bit of that humor, that over-the-top ridiculousness, that 90s excess, about kind of laughing at it. Sprinkle in a little Guardians of the Galaxy, add a dash of Wolverine, and you've got yourself you've got yourself Lobo. And I'm saying, like, in for better or for worse, like, there's money to be made with Lobo, who was a huge 90s character, who was this, you know, this monstrous mercenary Superman villain, a intergalactic bounty hunter with no scruples, and flying around in space on a giant motorcycle.
Pain Index.
He is ridiculous, but I definitely think that like Lobo is just sitting there as a property to be like to be taken to take some money out of some kids' pockets, and maybe reinvented in an interesting way that is no longer, you know, that like still has some of that appeal, but like done right, like done in a way that you're like, oh, I don't hate this, in a way that many people hated Lobo, but I never hated Lobo.
You're hurting me, Scott.
I always liked. What's that?
You said you're hurting me.
Come on, they're that great Mignola, that Mignola cover.
I'm just shocked. I'm more shocked than hurt.
That's right.
You know, I said go Robo, but I will never say go Lobo.
Like I say Lobo. Lobo, bring Lobo. Back Sheriff
bring back
Lobo. Lobo. So,
oh,
I mean, hey, who saw? Remember that Young Justice episode where he showed up? Great.
Yeah, not bad.
Not bad is right. So, we're talking about the 90s. We're talking about taking things that were like terrible in the 90s and making some money.
You know what? You're right.
I'm saying that Lobo is ridiculous, sure, but there's something interesting that could be done with him, and he's worthy of resurrection just to see, just for the challenge, for the degree of difficulty. I'd like to make a Lobo comic because Rob Liefeld tried to ape Lobo on Blood Wolf, and it was terrible. And I'm taking my I've already been kicked off the elevator. That's for sure. But they've taken my idea, and someone's making money off of it.
You guys remember when Wolverine beat Lobo behind the bar?
I don't want to talk about it.
Like nigh invulnerable space bounty hunter got beaten by the Wolverine behind a bar.
Well, that's what happened.
That's what the fans wanted. And they got it.
Sure did. So I'm saying Lobo. I'm sticking with Lobo. And
you know what? I love it. Like, you spot on. Right. Like, you nailed it. You nailed the 90s with that.
I went straight for the 90s, right? Took it right by the chained hook he seems to swing around a lot.
What a bastiche.
That's why I'm the main man.
Oh. Yeah, take that, fanboys. Bite me. We made Kettner
deep,
tap. Kettner tap.
I was just saying, Lobo versus Jack Knight. Who's going to win? It's an alien versus predator situation. Whoever wins.
And on that note, I guess we're getting off the elevator. I'm going to get some fresh air.
You definitely feel dirty. You need a shower.
Can you believe we survived the 90s and we still like comics after all that shit?
I can believe it.
After Deadpool, we still like comics. All right. Well, guys. Cool.
But now, how about after a Lobo Lobo movie? We'll see. We'll see.
Oh,
you heard it here first, kids.
I gotta go walk this episode off. I'll see you next week, guys.
We'll see you next week. Bye.
Bye-bye. We gonna rock, then we gonna roll, then we let it pop.